You're listening to KSCO, Santa Cruz, Salinas, Monterey, and San Jose, and 104 FM. This is From the Bookshelf. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for joining me. I have traveled to Iceland a few times, and it's a very magical and very peculiar place. In recent years, Iceland has become a very popular tourist destination. My guest, A. Kendra Green, has written a new book that captures perfectly the spirit and peculiar nature of this magical land. The book is called The Museum of Whales You Will Never See and Other Excursions to Iceland's Most Unusual Museums. A. Kendra Green is a journalist and printer, as well as an illustrator. A. Kendra Green, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Gary.
So how many times have you been to Iceland, I want to know?
I think it adds up to about 8 now. So I started going in 2011, and it's more or less every year since.
Is it because it's an addicting kind of place, or is it because you're working on the book, or why?
You know, I was not one of those smart people that knew you should go to Iceland for the sake of Iceland. I was looking for a reason to accept a travel grant while I was in grad school, and Iceland fit the bill. It's of all the places I've ever lived or traveled, it is the place that has attracted all my friends who said, hey, do you need a research assistant? Do you need a buddy? Do you want someone to drive the car? So apparently everyone knew but me. And once I got there, I realized there was so much to fall in love with.
Now, what about horses? Do you ride?
I've ridden one Icelandic horse. I appreciate that they are very low to the ground. I love that they have the fifth gait.
Yeah, but riding was not one of your motivations.
No, I didn't have any of the normal reasons to want to be interested in Iceland. And indeed, for all the years I've spent sitting around in museum cafes waiting for something to happen, I'll have this conversation, right? Someone will ask me what I'm up to. We'll get excited about the book. I'll tell them this amazing fact that the local museum studies professor counts about 265 museums and public collections in a country of 330,000 people, and they'll say, that's amazing, but no one comes to Iceland for the museums. And they can say this while sitting in a museum.
Yeah, so that works out to like one museum per person, essentially.
Basically, yeah, right. You've got your rock band going, your job in Parliament, and the museum you run on the side.
Yeah, so there's 300,000 people, 330,000 people. There are 250,000 horses, I think.
And sheep for everyone to have 5 apiece, I'm sure.
Sheeps. It is a very funny place, Iceland, and you kind of capture the humor of it, I think, in your book. Tell me a little bit about how you, so you're saying you were looking for a grant. So what were you looking for, and how did you come up with this concept?
Yeah, so I've got a background in museums. I started at the Museum of Contemporary Photography and ended up managing their collection. And it used to just amaze me how for places that are fundamentally storytelling institutions, we weren't doing anything to keep track of our own. We almost didn't talk about them, right? The institutional facade of presenting a story to the public, it was like it kept us from paying attention to our own. And right, shocking, amazing things happen in museums, right? We're trying to hold on to things and nothing wants to be held on to. And we're engaging with the public and you know something interesting was going to happen as soon as the unpredictability of other people coming in was put into play. So I've been thinking about museums and writing, and then I found Iceland. I went to look at one museum and was there for about 2 weeks trying to make sense of it. And as I was traveling the country for another 2 weeks trying to put it into context, I realized that basically everywhere I went had been founded since 2000, 1995 at the earliest. And there were just so many of them, right? Towns of 400 people could still have a museum, sometimes two.
And do you think that's because of the growth of tourism in recent years there?
That was always my first thought, right? The timing fits so perfectly. If this is a boom that we see in the last 20, 25 years, that stacks pretty neatly with this upswing in people discovering Iceland. But no one in Iceland seems to think this is the case, right? I've yet to find anyone who works at museums, studies museums, that is making that connection.
So why then are there all these museums?
So I think we have to look at a few factors. I think that partly it's a different kind of economics. It's just a place starting to get wealthy, right? Iceland's one of the poorest countries in the world, definitely in Europe, for most of the 1,000 years it's inhabited. And sort of coming out of World War II, you have people that are finally able to move out of turf houses. There are finally bridges that connect the whole country. They talk about the rubber boot when it's introduced, right? That you have the US and the British forces on the island. And these are people that have had wet feet, right? People that have been fishing, that have been walking the volcanic earth for 1,000 years with wet feet. And the rubber boot is so startling, so strange, that some people pour a little bit of water into it to make it feel normal again. So you've got a place that's been investing in story for a long time, right? There's not a lot of wealth. There's not a lot of the material stuff of culture that we're used to in other parts of the world, right? Not a lot of workable clay or metal, and basically nothing you could burn hot enough to work either of those things anyway. But the language, the song, the poetry, that's where you keep investing. And if you can tell a story, you can make a great museum.
Do you speak Icelandic?
Not in any reputable way. One of the things I love about Icelandic is that it starts to teach itself to you. The place name is very regular, right? You see enough fosses and you realize, wait a minute, they're all waterfalls. I've got it, right? You have enough vix, you realize they're all harbors. It's sort of amazing if you look at old Icelandic and old English side by side. It's like Spanish and Portuguese. You can tell that if you could read one, you could read the other. So, right, there's this sort of connecting back, like places where you start to see a common language and over time trying to know it better. But thank goodness I have Icelanders who helped me through the majority of it.
Well, it does seem that most Icelanders speak English.
And I have a evolving relationship with this idea, right? My first trip in 2011, I came back and said, I was there for a month. I met two Icelanders who didn't speak English, someone who was too old and someone who was too young to have started school. But it's so much more complicated than that. I've gotten really interested in the people that choose to bring interpreters to our interviews, even though, as far as I can tell, right, the everything seems to be making sense going back and forth, but the care of making sure that nothing gets lost is really important. And I love this addition of the translator. It slows things down. I can take notes at a much better pace. And right, you have this other voice making sure that nothing is forgotten, right? This neighbor, this friend, this family member who brings in one more voice into the total story of how it was.
Interesting. So have you encountered a lot of people who didn't speak English that are not old or young?
I think it's, again, it's a question of how you want to talk about speaks English. Iceland has, right, they say 100% literacy, right? This is a place where 10% of Icelanders will publish a book in their lifetime. Right, these are radically literate people, right? They're having conversations about what is going to happen to the language now that there is so much internet influence with their young, right? I remember sitting on a bus trip listening to a teenager on the phone who kept saying, OMGED, OMGED. And this is a place that has a government agency in charge of making sure that foreign words have an Icelandic alternative when they come into the language, right? So the cell phone, right, it makes that sort of on vibrate, it makes that so it's been given a word that is a archaic Icelandic word for a sheep, right? That sort of bleeding
Yes. Yeah, no, I've experienced that. Once in Iceland, I went to a soccer game by myself, and I don't speak any Icelandic at all, but except for one word, I can say Slökkvistad, which means fire station, as far as I can tell. But anyway, I went to this soccer game, and it was the only time I had been with all Icelandic people, so nobody was speaking English because they were all with themselves. And so it was really interesting to see, you know, it was pretty easy to follow what was going on because it was a sporting event. But their behavior at sporting events was funny, a lot more very different than our behavior at sporting events.
Gary, yeah. I want to know more about that.
Well, they had like these little, when I came in, they gave me this piece of cardboard. And I said, oh, well, that's nice. It was like a picture. And when I got to my seat, I realized that everybody had taken the cardboard and folded it in such a way that they could make noise with it. And they were like slapping their So they had the, and everybody, that's how they, rather than applaud or scream, they just slap this paper over and over again.
That's wonderful. There's a puffin in a aquarium, basically, off on the south end of Vestmannaeyjar that was named after the footballer that had the winning point the day that this puffin was found. And they've made it a tiny jersey. It's adorable.
Oh, that's funny. They really love their soccer there, for sure.
And their puffins.
And their puffin, yeah. So I want to know a little bit about, I want to know a lot about, actually, all these museums that you visited. And I also want to know about your bookmaking. So I was looking at your website, and some of these stories you've published previously as books that you've made?
Chapbooks with Anomalous Press. So they've had the letterpress covers, right, designed with wood type, right, printed on old Vandercooks, so that they, right, they have that toothy paper, right, it feels like an object in the hand. And partly that's because the tiny press I was working with, Anomalous, believes in the handmade object, right, believes in making these beautiful things. And it was a perfect fit for my training as a printer, as a bookbinder, and also, the more I think about it, right, really perfect and appropriate for this book, right, these museums and collections in Iceland are so much about, I think, this intersection of sort of these two basic human drives, right? We love stuff, right? Things. We can't get enough, right? We like that tactile material existence in the world. And we really love stories, right? Even more than we love things, we love stories. And we will keep, restore, invent, make the things if they help us tell the story. So being in the chapbook and now book business, it's been so important that these things, right, help tell the story and are, right, delights and wonders in their own right.
I'm Gary Shapiro. This is From the Bookshelf on KSCO, and we're talking tonight with A. Kendra Green. She's the author of The Museum of Whales You Will Never See and Other Excursions to Iceland's Most Unusual Museums.
And your book, The Museum of Whales You Will Never See and Other Excursions to Iceland's Most Unusual Museums, has lots of beautiful illustrations. Can you tell us a little bit about those?
Thank you for asking. When I made these, the chapbooks came out in 2015, 16, and 17. And with the first one, I was illustrating a friend's book, so I didn't have time to do my own, and was so glad that I could invite a writer, artist friend, Annie Nilsson, to do the illustrations. And for the last book, the writer and artist, Fozia Karimi, whose own book just debuted in April, Above Us, The Milky Way. And each time it was really exciting to see another artist interpret the words, right? It was so beautiful to have that, to be able to pass off that task and to have something surprising and exciting come back. So my editor and I knew with this book that we always wanted all the things, right? We wanted maps and appendices and front matter and end papers and illustrations. But the question was how to do them. And in September, John said, I've been thinking you should do them. And I'd like them by the end of the month, which was terrifying. You can imagine. But when I started to think about them, right, I have a whole backlog of photographs, right? I was a photographer before I was a writer. And there's a way of making images that I started doing as a letterpress printer, right? Thinking about what would ink. So, right, sort of simple line drawings. It's basically a light box, right? So I started out originally printing things and holding them up to the window. And I got a little more sophisticated when I realized that a tablet is a light box. So there are these, in the original, they're really sort of lovely. It's this vellum paper with ink on top of it. So they're sort of ethereal and the light comes through. And at the end of the day, I ended up with 60 drawings. And I think 37, 38 of them are in the book now. So these simple little line drawings.
They're quite beautiful.
Thank you.
So let's talk about these museums. Now, I once went to Tasmania. And when I was in Tasmania, I was in this town, which had been a big mining town with thousands of people, but is now a deserted mining town of a few hundred people. And there's a museum there. And in this museum, they have all this stuff that people, when they left, they donated it to the museum. So they have a whole room of vacuum cleaners and a whole room of people's telephones. But it's also a museum that captures what was once going on in this town. There's, you know, like memorabilia from the movie theater that was there that's no longer there and all these things. And I was thinking of that museum when I was reading about some of the museums that you visited in Iceland, that the difference between a collection and a museum, which is something you were dealing with in your book. Can you talk about that a little?
Well, I think about the first time I went to Iceland, and I was just gobsmacked that the border between the private collection and the public museum, it was like it didn't exist, right? It was so easily transgressed. And it took me a while to catch up with the fact that it's there in the language. The Icelandic word sap is both collection and museum, right? You can have a sap of sheep. If you drive by the library, it's a bokensap. So right there, they're easy to make. They don't have a transition to make in some sense. It's just a question of how many people are dropping by and have you decided to charge admission. But in sort of broad strokes, I think there are kind of two Icelandic museums. There is what they call the same thing from 50 different farms and the hyper niche museum, right? You can have one museum that only cares about the history of French fishermen in Iceland, which is a fabulous and thrilling topic and worth existing, if only to tell us that it was such dangerous work that the women who married those sailors were known as the widows of Iceland even before their husbands died.
Yeah. So which of the museums are your favorites and most unusual or interesting?
You know, that's a hard question, Gary. I have a very special place in my heart for the Sea Monster Museum, or I believe it's actually the Icelandic Sea Monster Museum, because it's an oral history museum, which is the sort of thing we should have tons of, but you've probably never heard of one. I think this challenge to try to display what can't be seen really opens up the storytelling possibilities. I always worry about the local history museum, the way that it can get tied to, there's only the things that we have and we have to pull the stories out of them, right? So all of the vacuum cleaners, right? Whatever happens to be here. I think museums are often at their best when they get to flip it, when they get to prioritize, this is the story you need to hear, right? This is the story that's going to illuminate something, that's going to change something, that's going to resonate with you. And here's a thing that will help us get there. So I think you should drop by the Museum of Prophecy and have your fortune read. I think you should definitely go to the Museum of Icelandic Witchcraft and Sorcery. You should make your way all the way out to the east to Petra's stone collection, where her family will take your ticket, meet you in the gift shop. And if you can sneak into the kitchen, you could hang out with guides who've been going to the same private house for the last 40 years.
And so you were saying that many of the museums turn into restaurants because the people who come to visit have to eat something.
It was a big surprise to me how much of this book is about food. I think partly it's just hospitality, right? The motorcycle museum will make sure that you have coffee at the very least. But the more far-flung you are, the more likely it is that you are the thing in town or you're the thing in town that's open. And so you start offering accommodation after accommodation, and before you know it, you've got a restaurant that has vegetarian options and local options. And that's beside the waffles they make with the rhubarb jam that was made on somebody's stove across the street.
And you saw some things in such as the invisible boy. How do they have an invisible boy in the museum?
Well, he's trapped in a case, so he's not getting out. And if you look, there's sort of a bed of sand at the bottom, these sort of coarse pebbles. And there are the footprints of a boy. You'll have to look a little bit harder to see the rest of the child.
there's a town, and I can't pronounce anything in Icelandic except for Shlokristad. But there's a town that's called
Stykkishólmur.
Yeah. And they have the Library of Water there.
The beautiful Ronnie Horn exhibition. Yeah.
It's a very strange place. and very crowded. It was a crowded way getting into the Library of Water.
Right, to put on your little slippers so that you can walk over the all of the words for weather as you go amid these columns with glacial water collected from each glacier in Iceland. Right in an old library overlooking the harbor with a beautiful lighthouse.
An amazing place.
And right, it's one of, I think, three museums in town, right? To get there anymore, you pick up the keys at the Volcano Museum, run by a Brown University geologist who retired and came back to Iceland, took over the old movie theater for what you would think is a geology collection, and it is, but it's also an art museum of volcano art from around the world. They have an Andy Warhol who made two landscapes in his life, one of which is a volcano.
Which is there, yes. Yep. That's a beautiful museum. And when I went there, I was the only visitor. And they spent quite a lot of time with me, which was very nice to them.
I'm glad you've had that experience. As somebody that can afford to plan out to just sit at a museum for days and days at a time, it calls back a thing that I really used to love when I worked at museums, which is the opportunity to live with an exhibition, right? The way that things change over time, right? Enough time to realize that something keeps giving to you, or that it's a thing that everything you knew about it, you knew in the first 10 seconds you met it, doesn't change 3 months later.
Yeah, so that's how I think of all museum exhibits, but you're saying that isn't the case. They change over time?
Well, my experience in getting to work at museums, right? So living with an exhibition for its whole run, there are things that, right, you will see a little bit differently the next week or the week after, right? Or you'll read something and it'll add to it, or you'll just have enough time, or somebody says something and it changes what you see from it, right? What you're getting out of it. Some things are like that. And then there are other things where you can spend 5 months with it and that relationship never changes.
Well, one place that I've never been in Reykjavik is the Penis Museum. I know that it's there.
I hear that it's moving. It sounds like they're going to be in a place that's three times as big.
So people are with their penises. But
an institution that keeps moving and growing.
But, you know, I think that until I read your piece about it, I was sort of like not interested in the Penis Museum, but now probably next time. Ironically, I was planning on being in Iceland in June, but because of this situation we're in, I won't be going then, but possibly later in the year or next year for sure. But talk to us a little bit about the Penis Museum, that it's not, you found that it's not anything that you thought it would be, that people would think it was.
Yeah, and I really sympathize. I wouldn't have thought to go to it either. I wouldn't have thought to give it really any attention. It sounds on the face of it sophomoric at best, right? That it sounds like it's trying to surprise you. A friend of mine had sent me a list of the, I think, the 10 wackiest museums in the world, right? An internet list. We should all be very proud that two of them are domestic, right here. They are American institutions. And I wouldn't have clicked on the Icelandic Phallological Museum. I just would have overlooked it, except I'd met one Icelander in my life. My sister was putting in a new kitchen, and one of her colleagues from work, he and I had volunteered to help. And so we were there on the floor with our IKEA diagrams and our levels. And I said, "Gardar, I'm sort of embarrassed, but I don't really know anything about Iceland. What's something I should know?" And there are a lot of things he could have chosen to tell me. But the one thing Gardar said was, "We have a penis museum, the only one in the world," which was enough to click on it. That got me over the threshold. And then once I was looking around to see if there was a translation, the website came up in Icelandic, and I realized it was in seven languages, including Esperanto. I began to think, there might be something here. And I think fundamentally, it is at its heart, it's a museum about language, right? It is about both this very physical fact and a great distance from that fact to how we talk about it. Right, it's a thing that was a joke at the bar for a long time before it was ever a place you could go visit. And I think what's amazing is how that joke translates, right? It's not, it's a, it is in fact a serious institution, right? Comparative anatomy was an important part of our thinking in evolution, right? It is foundational in the work of Cuvier and Huxley and Darwin, right? It's an actual part of science that we should really pay more attention to and remember. And you don't until you're in this place that you go to because you think it's going to be a joke. And the joke is that it's what it said it would be. You just didn't think that was possible.
Well, I think one of my favorite lines in your book is you said something about the fact that there are no tracks in Iceland and therefore no wrong side of the tracks.
It was a place I didn't understand how to navigate when I first got there, right? There is no train. Why would there be a train? Right? It's, like I say, it's a country that you couldn't get around the whole thing by road until the 70s, right? There just weren't enough bridges. This is a place where you were isolated in where you start, or you have to row there, or you have to ride there.
Or ride on horses.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. This is a place where the distance to travel used to be measured in how many pairs of shoes it would take you to get there, because the fish skin, the seal skin, the lamb skin of your shoe would just be torn to tatters, right, walking along that volcanic earth.
Talk a little bit about herring and its place in Icelandic culture. There's a herring museum, obviously.
I'm so glad you asked. When I tell people, right, when I was writing it at the time, and now when I mentioned that there's a herring essay in the book, no one gets as excited as we really should get. So the herring era is, I believe, 1905, 1903 to 1967. Well, 1967 peak, more herring than we've ever seen. And then in 1969, nothing. Right, it's a huge export, the silver of the sea, God's gift, right? It does a lot for the Icelandic economy. And you have a town, Siglufjordur, which was just bustling, right? It was the epicenter of all of this, thousands of people there to work, but also painters would come, right? There were musicians in the street, this incredibly cosmopolitan place making money, which, again, was kind of a first for Iceland. And then, right, it suddenly stops, right? You have this boom town, and then it becomes a ghost town. And it's really amazing, right? All of this infrastructure that's built out. So you were surrounded by the history of what was and watching it all fall apart. I love the fact that the Siglufjordur Fire Department in the 1970s and 80s was known to be the best fire department in the country because they had so much to set on fire and then put out.
A lot of practice.
Yeah.
Well, fish is a big thing there. I mean, obviously, because it's Iceland, but I mean, fish at every meal. And some very disgusting fish, I have to say.
Well, and there's the dried fish, right, that is very good, like lots of protein. I'm told it's the perfect hiker snack. But you also have to be sent with some butter because otherwise, right, it's just too sharp, right? You have to be able to oil it up again if you're going to chew it.
Yeah, I know. Well, I'm not a big fish fan. But
hopefully you like lamb then, or yes, rhubarb jam, coffee.
Lamb is great. My wife went to this fish place, a cannery thing, and they had these beautiful burlap sacks, and she thought, oh, these would be great, you know, to bring home and use in some artwork. And so she got some brand new ones from the guy who was very happy to give them to her, and she took them back to her hotel room, and immediately it smelled so badly of fish that they had to take them back because even though they were brand new, they reeked.
I love the founders of the Icelandic Sea Monster Museum. It's on a harbor, and it's a museum that exists in part because the fishing rights were sold away, and right, a town of 400 people suddenly had no work. So you're sitting there, right, on the harbor of a fishing town, talking to founders who say, "What is it about tourists that you always want fish? You know what's good? Lamb's fat on rye bread."
I have an Icelandic friend who basically feels that everything on Earth that's good was invented by Icelanders and then stolen by the Europeans, and then now it's being sold back to them.
I really want to see this list.
Everything. There's not a single thing that he doesn't say. We invented that, and now they're selling it back to us.
Well, the Icelanders get to take credit for the French Revolution. Their volcano causes crop failures around the world for 4 years. Without it, democracy does not look the same.
Speaking of that, I visited the president's home because he wasn't there. And my friend was a friend of the guard of the president's home, you know, like basically the Icelandic White House. So we got to go in there and wander around. Not on a tour or anything, just he wasn't home. So
just stop in. It's like you're in a Jane Austen novel.
Iceland is a very funny place. And you really capture it, I think, so well in this book. And the book, again, is called The Museum of Whales You Will Never See and Other Excursions to Iceland. The Museum of Whales you Will Never See. Now, wait a minute. There is a Museum of Whales that you haven't seen that you will never see.
Well, and this is interesting that the actual piece in the book is the museums of whales you will never see, because there's the museum I cannot find, right? This gas station whale museum I've heard such good things about, but they never answer the phone. They aren't on the map where the address says they should be. I cannot find them, and I've been trying for years. And there's a museum that I've gotten as far as its doors. I know exactly where it is. But I really prefer knowing it through all of the stories I hear from the museum professionals in town. Visiting it, I don't think can compare. So the title of the book actually gives us one more fictional institution in the singular Museum of Whales you will never see.
The Museum of Whales You Will Never See and Other Excursions to Iceland's Most Unusual Museums. And the author, my guest, A. Kendra Green. Kendra, thank you so much for spending some time with us on From the Bookshelf.
Gary, it's been a total pleasure. Thank you for taking me back to Iceland for a little while.
A. Kendra Green, author of The Museum of Whales You Will Never See and Other Excursions to Iceland's Most Unusual Museums. I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf on KSCO. Woody Allen has published his autobiography, Apropos of Nothing. Before I share my thoughts on the book, let's listen to a bit of Woody Allen's act as a stand-up comedian.
I was kidnapped once. I was standing in front of my schoolyard, and a black sedan pulls up. And two guys get out, and they say to me, do I want to go away with them to a land where everybody is fairies and elves? And I could have all the comic books I want, and chocolate, and wax lips, you know? And I said yes, you know? And I got into the car with them, because I figured, you know, what the hell? I was home that weekend from college anyhow. They drive me off, and they send a ransom note to my parents. And my father has bad reading habits. So he gets into bed at night with the ransom note. And he read half of it, you know. And he got drowsy and fell asleep. Then he lent it out, you know. Meanwhile, they take me to New Jersey, bound and gagged. And my parents finally realize that I'm kidnapped. And they snap into action immediately. They rent out my room. The ransom note says for my father to leave $1,000 in a hollow tree in New Jersey. He has no trouble raising $1,000, but he gets a hernia carrying the hollow tree. The FBI surround the house. Throw the kid out, they say. Give us your guns and come out with your hands up. The kidnappers say, we'll throw the kid out, but let us keep our guns and get to our car. The FBI says, throw the kid out. We'll let you get to your car, but give us your guns. The kidnappers say, we'll throw the kid out and let us keep our guns. We don't have to get to our car. The FBI says, keep the kid. The FBI decides to lob in tear gas, but they don't have tear gas. So several of the agents put on the death scene from Camille. Tear stricken, my abductors give themselves up. They're sentenced to 15 years on a chain gang, and they escape, 12 of them chained together at the ankle. getting by the gods posing as an immense charm bracelet.
That was Woody Allen, author of a new autobiography entitled Apropos of Nothing. I reviewed the book recently for listeners of Good Morning Monterey Bay with Rosemary Chalmers here on KSCO.
I tore through a book this week, the new book by Woody Allen, which is called Apropos of Nothing.
Oh, you've read it already.
I have indeed. And it's interesting. You know, a couple of months ago, we were talking about Ronan Farrow's book, which is a story about how when Ronan Farrow, who is the son of Mia Farrow and possibly the son of Woody Allen, Mia Farrow says now that Frank Sinatra is actually Ronan Farrow's father, but Ronan Farrow's book was all about how he was working on the Harvey Weinstein investigation when he was working for NBC television, and they wanted to stop the story, and basically he left there because they wouldn't let him pursue a story that he wanted to tell, and then he ended up telling the story and winning a Pulitzer Prize and all that.
Yeah, look at that.
So a couple of, I guess about 4 weeks ago, when Hachette Books announced that they were publishing Woody Allen's book in April, Apropos of Nothing, is the title of the book, Ronan Farrow, who had his book published by Hachette Books, rallied against them publishing the book. He didn't want the book to be published, and he didn't want them to publish it, and he got all of the employees of Hachette Books to walk out, and so they stopped publication of the book. And
isn't that remarkable?
Yeah, here he is, a guy who wrote a book about someone stopping a story, and he campaigned to get a story stopped.
Yeah, and, well, of course, he was temporarily successful. Who picked it up and published it then afterwards?
A company called Skyhorse Books has published the book.
Okay, yes, I've heard of them before.
And it's a big book. It's like 400 pages book, and it has absolutely no chapters. It just begins and goes to the end without any... There's not a chapter...
Wow, that's weird.
Yeah, you know, just straight ahead, straight through. And it's hilarious. I mean, it's because it's Woody Allen. It's very, very funny. And so cleverly written. Like, he talks about his childhood. He said, I was healthy, popular, athletic, always chosen first for teams, a ball player, a runner, and yet somehow I managed to turn out nervous, fearful, and emotional wreck, hanging on by a thread to my composure, misanthropic, claustrophobic, isolated, embittered, impeccably pessimistic. Some people see the glass half empty, some see it half full. I always saw the coffin half full.
Oh, gosh.
A thousand natural shocks that flesh is heir to, I managed to avoid most, except number 682. No denial mechanism. And when he talks about his family and his early life, he says, we had a relative named Phil Wasserman, whom I will return to soon, as he was a major contributor to my career. But there is also another relative named Phil Wasserman, equally important as he's always referred to as the other Phil Wasserman. So in conversations about either Phil Wasserman, one always had to specify, and one did, by saying, I was walking in Manhattan and I ran into the other Phil Wasserman, or I have to buy a gift for the other Phil Wasserman. And as a child, I wondered if when he phoned, he opened with, hi, it's the other Phil Wasserman. did his wife say, this is my husband, the other Phil Wasserman? Or on his tombstone, does it say, here lies the other Phil Wasserman?
Oh, that is funny, I have to say. Very entertaining.
Yeah, it is. But then, of course, he also talks about his relationship with his wife, Sun Yi, who he's been married to, by the way, for 25 years. And they have two children. And, you know, and he talks about the whole scandal of his career. And but he does say, you know, I'll be getting to this in a while, but I hope that's not the reason you bought the book.
Like he's talking to you.
Yeah, like he's talking to you. You know, the scandal of his career today, he is linked, you know, lumped in with people like Harvey Weinstein and other people who have been either convicted or charged with multiple crimes of sexual harassment or rape. And he is always lumped in with them, even in the New York Times or in book reviews of his book. But he has never been, he's been accused by his daughter, Dylan, of molesting her. But other than that accusation, he has never been accused of anything by anyone else. And two investigations into this, and he talks about this in detail, completely exonerated him, saying that there was no sign of any actual molestation taking place.
I think he was tried in the court of public opinion.
Tried in the court of public opinion. The only time he was ever tried of anything was when he went to court for against Mia Farrow for visitation rights, you know, for his children, of which he has three with Mia Farrow and two adopted children with his wife, Sun Yi. He also talks about how, you know, he was never married to Mia Farrow. He never lived with her. And how Mia Farrow makes it look as though Sun Yi, Mia Farrow described her as retarded and that she was a child, although she was 20 when she and Woody Allen met her, 22, something like that.
Yeah, that was a very, it made people very uncomfortable, that's for sure.
Well, sure. I mean, you know, there's no denying that he's married to a woman who was the adopted daughter of the woman he was dating. And that's in itself, you know,
weird.
Yeah.
That's weird. But
there's
then
a
again,
lot of women in the world that he could have chosen other than the woman who was the adopted daughter of the woman he'd been dating for.
Sure, but the fact that she was an adult, we didn't all of us take that into consideration. And I was part and parcel of that feeling that it was like totally inappropriate.
Yes. Also, although he probably could have chosen a different person, that's the person he loves and has been married to for 25 years.
Yeah, it was easy to knock at the time, though.
Most of the book, by far, is about filmmaking and the movies that he's made and his career. He says, I did not include technical details about my filmmaking because I find them a bore, and I don't know any more about lighting and photography now than when I started. I was never curious enough to learn. I do know that you have to remove the lens cap from the camera before you film something. There my technical expertise ends. When I direct, I know what I want, or more important, I know what I don't want. He does talk a lot about the writing of films and the acting in films. He's talking about one of his films in which Christopher Walken, the fine actor, was cast. And Christopher Walken had already been in a movie with him. That was Annie Hall. But in this movie, he wasn't happy with the performance. He said, Chris is one of our finest actors, and when things were not working out, I looked for the reason in the wrong place. I studied his performance to figure out the problem, but I should have been examining the writing. Always look at the writing first when something's not working. As the days passed, Chris was becoming more and more uncomfortable in the part, and finally, in the nicest, most gentlemanly way, he quit, assuring me that he thought I was a brilliant director who had a great future once I beat the problem of delusional self-worship.
Oh, really? It sounds like he's an open book in this book.
He really is. He says, if I had my life to do over, would I do anything different? I would not purchase that miracle vegetable slicer the guy advertised on TV.
A lot of us feel that way about the vegetable slicer that we bought from the guy on TV.
But I do recommend the book. I think it's a lot of fun. And, you know, and it's, if you're a Woody Allen fan, absolutely. But it's also, you know, interesting from the historical point of view of what's happened to him and his career. Currently, currently he's having trouble because he had a deal with Amazon, which they broke the deal because his accusations from his daughter Dylan resurfaced when she published kind of an open letter in a trade magazine or in the newspapers about how, you know, he's escaped because he's a powerful person and therefore he raped her and was allowed to get away with it. And now people don't want to work with him. People who have worked with him said that they're very sorry that they did and that they gave their money, their salary to charity. Which Woody Allen says, you know, that's great, but, you know, he only pays scale. So the amount they gave to charity.
It's not very much.
Not that much.
Oh, great. And the book again is?
It's called Apropos of Nothing by Woody Allen.
Thanks so much, dear. Talk to you in a couple of weeks.
Bye-bye.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next week. In the meantime, check out our podcast page at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts, and you can like us on Facebook. I'm Gary Shapiro. Thanks for listening.